ISIS today, one must be anti-Zionist. The statement begins, U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel stands in solidarity with movements resisting Trump's authoritarian, racist, misogynist, neoliberal, and violently imperial policies. It goes on to say, at the same time, we've been reinvigorated by the spread of popular resistance and mass protests across the U.S. We are inspired by the intensified coalitions that have linked immigrant rights, anti-capitalist, feminist, environmentalist, anti-war, queer, indigenous, and anti-fascist movements, and that have built on struggles such as Black Lives Matter, water protectors protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, and sanctuary activism. These movements portend a challenge and opportunity for progressives and other leftists everywhere. As an organization committed to solidarity with the Palestinian freedom struggle and an end to U.S. support for Israeli apartheid and occupation, we have also been struck by the conjecture between the Trump regime's Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism and its anti-Semitism. We want to note the disturbing and telling ways that the Trump administration and alt-right movement's support for white nationalism dovetails with its promotion of Zionism. There is an often seemingly paradoxical convergence between this simultaneous advocacy of white supremacy, Zionism, and anti-Semitism. Joining us today to discuss the statement and how one can condemn white racists for fighting to preserve their privileges and supremacy in their homeland, while defending the right of Israel to maintain a regime based on exactly those values, is member of the organizing collective for the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, Professor David Lloyd. Professor David Lloyd is a distinguished professor of English at the University of California, Riverside, and a founding member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Professor Lloyd's research and writing centers on Irish culture and colonialism. He has also written extensively on settler colonialism in Palestine and on the academic and cultural boycott. His most recent article, published at Mondo Weiss on Tuesday, is titled Racial Supremacy and the Zionist Exception. I am happy to welcome a fellow KPFK programmer, host and producer of Swana Region Radio, Professor David Lloyd, back to Middle East in Focus.
Thanks very much. It's great to be on the show today, and particularly at a moment when our statements suddenly gained a different kind of meaning after Charlottesville. So,
right.
Thank you for doing the show.
Also joining our conversation here in studio is Eliyahu Unger Sargon, an award-winning filmmaker who has spoken and written extensively about issues of human rights, religion, and politics. His films include the 2007 feature documentary Cut, Slicing Through the Myths of Circumcision, Questions of Life and Death, a short documentary featuring an Israeli assassin, and his 2015 award-winning feature documentary, A People Without a Land, which presents dedicated Israelis and Palestinians, many of whom have undergone personal transformations and are now harnessing their passion for change while attempting to revolutionize their societies. It is my pleasure to welcome another friend and fellow filmmaker, Eliyahu Unger Sargon, back to Middle East in Focus.
Thanks, Esty. It's really good to be here.
Well, you know, very timely, this conversation that we are having. Professor Lloyd, it does seem like this moment in America is highlighting the discriminatory character at the core of Zionism, which is the political movement responsible for the founding of Israel and remains at the very core of Israeli state policy. How long has U.S. ACBI been working on the statement?
Well, the statement itself came together quite quickly, and I should start by saying I was not one of our collective who actually wrote the piece, though our process always invites consensus on anything we produce, and all of us agreed on the statement before it was published, but I was not one of its writers, and I want to salute those who did write it. So the statement has been in the works for a while, Largely on account of the fact that Zionist organizations have been increasingly trying to use the label of anti-Semitism to denigrate and delegitimate people who support either BDS or simply who are in support of lesser measures to criticize Israel and its policies in occupation, in discrimination, in dispossession, and so forth. So it seemed clear to us, since we were constantly dealing in our area, in particular, with university administrators and campus officials who would succumb to this charge of anti-Semitism on their campuses without a second thought, that we really needed to put the ball back in the other court and point out that Zionism itself is a racism, and indeed, as increasing numbers of scholars, including a large number now of Israeli scholars, are pointing out, Zionism is a peculiar philosophy because it in itself is actually anti-Semitic in quite distinct ways. Those scholars usually mean by that it really has had deep antagonism towards the traditions of the diaspora, which for a very long time really defined what Judaism was. And so that the Zionism is seen by a number of these scholars as a kind of Christian-style redemption of the Jew from their Jewishness. And I find that an interesting argument. But our point is more that in its actual enactment, Zionism has engaged in racist forms of settler colonialism that began with the Nakba and the expulsion of 750,000-plus Palestinians, but is continuing to the present day with that campaign of dispossession, annexation, and really quite violent violations of basic Palestinian human rights.
Right. Eliyahu Unger Sargon, you've written extensively on these issues. I wonder, have you read the full statement by U.S. ACBI, and do you have any objections to any of the arguments that it makes?
Yeah, so I did read the statement, and I think I'd give it a B+. Like, for the most part.
I think David just thanked you.
No, I mean, for the most part, I agree with the substance of the arguments being made. I have a few nits to pick, some things that stuck in my craw a little bit. The biggest issue I had with the statement, and again, I do agree with the substance of the intersectional analysis. I agree that Zionism, as it's practiced today by the State of Israel, is absolutely related in very interesting ways to white supremacy. And demographics is kind of at the center of the way the Israeli government and Zionists, since the establishment of the State of Israel, have looked at their project. But the line about the chosen people in the statement, I think, rubbed me the wrong way for two reasons. The first is, I think, and I see this on the left a lot, actually, I think there's kind of a misunderstanding of how that concept functions in the Jewish religion, like in the actual sort of in the way people view it, the way people are raised to think about it. There's often a sort of elision between this old concept and Zionist supremacist ideas, which I don't think it stands to scrutiny. In other words, yes, there is this concept of the chosen people in the Jewish tradition historically, but the Zionist movement for the most part was a secular movement, and it wasn't really reaching to religious concepts like the chosen people when they were making their own justification. So on the one side, like that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And it also sort of leaves an opening for accusations of anti-Semitism, because quite frankly, historically, the concept of the chosen people has been used by the church, by Christians, in anti-Jewish ways. And so for those two reasons, that part of the statement I felt like was problematic. But for the most part, I mean, I agree with the substance of the analysis. I agree. I actually really liked David's piece for Mondeweiss, in which I think he gave a lot more subtlety, right, and he had more space, obviously, than the statement.
And on that topic, just to let people know, this is Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. I'm discussing the U.S. campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel's recent statement, Trumpism, white supremacy, and Zionism. with a member of that collective, Professor David Lloyd, and writer-filmmaker of, among other works, the 2015 documentary A People Without a Land, Eliyahu Unger Sargon. Professor Lloyd, in your piece this week at Mondo Weiss, titled Racial Supremacy and the Zionist Exception, you write, quote, "The contradiction between condemning U.S. racism and support for the racist ideology of Zionism has become steadily more glaring. Americans have had to confront the fact that white supremacy is an intrinsic, if shameful, element in their history and institutions whose consequences have yet to be overcome. But the same awareness has yet to extend to the remarkably similar and equally consequential worldview of Zionism."
Yeah, I mean, obviously I stand by that statement. I mean, I think that while there has been a lot of historical thinking, critical thinking about the legacy of U.S. settler colonialism, of slavery, of the genocide of Native Americans, of the exclusion acts against Asians, of discrimination against Latinos, and so forth, we are clearly still living with the consequences of those things and have to take that investigation and act upon it further than we have. It's clear to me that white supremacists are still appealing to a past that is attractive to a section of the white American population, because it's seen as a way to preserve against the threat of a, you know, increasingly multicultural society, of them losing privileges that are economic as much as anything else, but also psychic privileges of a sense of superiority. What is ironic is that just at the moment when politicians, church people, and other religious leaders are rushing to condemn white supremacy in this country, they're not as quick to do the same thing about Zionism, which shares, as we try to point out in the statement, many, many affinities with white supremacy. The most important one being the one I stress, I think, in the article, which is this anxiety about being replaced or displaced from the land, and therefore going along with that, the urge to dispossess and transfer or ethnically cleanse the native population. And that is simply not being addressed. I was very interested, actually, to read again the bill that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is a bill which, according to the ACLU, would penalize and even criminalize support for BDS. In that bill, it's not just that it seeks to criminalize BDS. What it is actually reacting against is a statement by the UN Human Rights Council, which asks people to boycott not Israel as a whole, nor corporations that do business as a whole, but those that do business with entities, Israeli entities, beyond the 1949 armistice line, that is, in the occupied territories. Now, it is actually internationally recognized that the occupation of these territories, of the Palestinian territories, is illegal. No country has the right to permanently occupy or settle its population on lands taken in war. So it is actually part of U.S. government policy, which is why the embassy has yet to be moved to Jerusalem, that East Jerusalem, which is included in the UN recommendations, is part of the occupied territories. Now, in other words, what the UN is asking for is to use some force, the force of economic sanctions, to put teeth into international law. The U.S., according to its own stated policy, ought to be actually enforcing that. However, these senators, including some of our local progressive senators, rather than doing that, are endorsing the idea that Israel should not be penalized for illegally occupying another people's territory. Now, that seems to me really interesting. It's giving endorsement to the extreme claims of certain sectors of Zionism that Israel should occupy the whole of what they regard as the territory of the Holy Land, that is, to use this expression, from the river to the sea, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. Now that is really giving endorsement to all the Zionists' most supremacist ideas about their rights over this land. So it's not just that progressives are succumbing to AIPAC's desire to penalize those of us who believe in holding Israel accountable to human rights and international law, but also that they're endorsing the most extreme versions of Zionism.
That's right. And that's House Resolution 1697 they were talking about, and we will get back to that. But because you brought up the armistice line or the green line, Eliyahu Unger Sargon grew up in Ramot, which is a settlement just north of Jerusalem across the green line. It faces historic Palestinian town of Lifta, a village which is emblematic of the tragedy of the founding of Israel, or what Palestinians commonly refer to as the Nakba, which means the catastrophe in Arabic. I wonder, Eliyahu, if you can discuss how you feel about that place now and how it was to film there when you made A People Without a Land.
Yeah, I mean, I have very complicated feelings about that place. My family still has a home in the settlement of Ramot, and you can actually see the ruins of Lifta from the backyard of the house. And as my awareness grew around the subject, both through talking to people and the process of making my film, it became more and more difficult for me to look at those ruins, and sort of their meaning started to crystallize in my mind in a very painful way. And so going there to film, I think I went on three separate occasions to try and get the footage of the ruins that are a very important part of my film. It just got harder and harder each time. And it's, yeah, I mean, I don't know what, it's one of those things that, you know, you go through a sort of personal, consciousness raising, and it can be very painful and it can be very enlightening. And then also, ultimately you feel the moral burden of, sharing with other people. And that's sort of the process that I went through.
This is Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler speaking with writer-filmmaker Eliyahu Unger Sargon and UC Riverside's Professor David Lloyd about the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. David, to go back to what you were talking about before, my congressman, Brad Sherman, as well as Adam Schiff, Ted Lieu, Nanette Barragan, Lou Correa, Grace Napolitano, Tony Cardenas, Juan Vargas, and three additional California Democratic congressional representatives are co-sponsors of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, H.R. 1697. And this bill would literally criminalize political speech that advocates boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, against companies supporting the apartheid system in Israel. The ACLU says that the bill would punish individuals for no reason other than their political beliefs. You wrote in your article that all have signed on to a bill that would protect the state of Israel by imposing civil and possibly criminal penalties on anyone who protests its ongoing violations of Palestinian rights, including illegal settlement and dispossession, by advocating for the boycott of its economic, academic, and cultural institutions. So it sounds like you have read the legislation, and I wonder how do you see prosecutors being able to go after individuals engaged in cultural and academic boycott within this legislation if it is indeed passed?
Okay, so let me first say that, yes, a number of so-called progressive congresspeople, including those you mentioned, are supporting this legislation. Many of us have actually written to their offices to ask them not to, and I have yet to hear from either Adam Schiff, who's my congressperson, or Ted Lieu or Brad Sherman, any response whatsoever to our protest of their being as sponsors of this bill. But let me just say, some of them have claimed, like Ron Wyden in Oregon, that, oh, no, it doesn't do any of these things. Frankly, I think it's about the complexity of the way the bill is written. If you go to the Congress and look up this bill, which is also Senate Bill 720, they're the same bill, you'll find that it's really an amendment to other bills. Now, that means that the language that the ACLU has singled out is not actually in the bill as you look at it. It's in the amendment, in the bill that is to be amended. Now, when you follow through, as The Intercept did in its article alerting people to this bill, the language is very ambiguous. If you read it, it seems to be just talking about the United Nations and the European Union, who have also recommended divestment from or sanctions on companies doing business in the occupied territories specifically. However, it only says such as the United Nations, and further, language is smuggled in which talks not only about the United Nations and international government organizations, but in the definition, which is actually smuggled into Chapter 27, 4201, paragraph 20 of Commercial Partnerships, Section B definition. That's how far down you have to go to find this. It says, in this paragraph, the term actions to boycott, divest from, or sanction Israel means actions by states, non-member states of the United Nations, international organizations, or affiliated agencies of international organizations that are politically motivated and are intended to penalize or otherwise limit commercial relations specifically with Israel. So, in other words, international organizations is wonderfully ambiguous. In my view, U.S. ACBI is part of an international organization founded by the Palestinian movement for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. It's unclear to me whether or not, and it's clearly unclear to the ACLU, we could actually be understood to be an international organization and therefore sanctioned. The ACLU further claims that it affects U.S. persons and not just corporations that would engage in divestment. But even without those, it is trying to put into law a criminal penalty that would fall on any corporation that refuses to do business. Does that mean, for example, that when our Students for Justice in Palestine ask our cafeterias run by the University of California, Riverside, not to stock Sabra hummus, which is a product of the occupied territories, that the student union or the university itself might be liable for penalty under this act? It's very hard to tell, and it leaves a lot of discretion to interpretation.
Right. Now, the other thing this legislation is actually amending two separate pieces of legislation.
That's right.
And there is language that actually refers to, it would also apply to U.S. persons. So it's not just companies or organizations. It's also U.S. persons.
I just want to jump in here for a second and just reflect on what an overreach this is. I mean, I think just strategically it's foolish. I don't think it has much of a chance of surviving the system here. I think maybe on some level they're hoping that they can sort of slip it by without too many people noticing. But you have even someone like Senator Warren coming out against this class of legislation. And I certainly hope it won't go anywhere. I support the people who are fighting it, but I just think it's a strategic miscalculation.
Well, just to be perfectly clear, I am one of those people that are fighting it. I do work with Jewish Voice for Peace on the legislative leadership team, and we are fighting this along with many other allied organizations across the country. And even somebody like Senator Warren, who came out against the legislation, made sure to profess that she is against the BDS movement as a tactic. It so happens that my congressman, Brad Sherman, is having a town hall meeting at 3:00 today at Reseda High School. And if people are moved, if people are incensed that not only are they shaming and punishing students and activists for their choice to use the nonviolent tactics of boycott and divestment, but now they're trying to criminalize those nonviolent tactics, they should come out to Reseda High School and let our congressman know how they feel about that.
And just to finish the thought, I mean, I think when you see the other side employing these sorts of tactics, my interpretation is that they're at a point of desperation. And they feel like they're losing the fight, and that's why they have to resort to this sort of thing.
I would entirely agree with that. I mean, we've noticed this, that 10 years ago it was possible to actually debate people who supported Zionism and were, you know, uncritically supportive of Israel. Now they won't even debate us, because in fact the more the facts about Israel's discriminatory laws and as well as its practices on the occupied territories are exposed in debate and in public discussion, the less ground they have to support what's happening and the violations of human rights and international law. And instead, what happens is this increasing resort to legislation, about which I also want to say this legislation is part of what I think of as the weird spreading toxicity of Zionism. In order to suppress our free speech, they are introducing legislation that opens the door to anti-boycott legislation generally. You know, once you've set the precedent of condemning boycott on one issue, the next thing that can happen is that a corporation decides that it will ask its congresspeople who it funds to support legislation outlawing boycott on their product or their relationships. So there's something about the way in which Zionism has become increasingly repressive, both in Israel and in this country, that has potentially really dire consequences for a free society in general. And I think it is unfortunately part of the logic of Zionism itself, that you cannot sustain a country based on manifest violations of human rights and equality without having to resort to increasingly draconian measures to support it. And I think the recent history of Zionism in Israel is really showing that as the Knesset passes more and more repressive legislation. But Eli could probably talk more to that.
Right. Well, I thank you both very much for having this conversation. And that legislation is something that we definitely need to fight back on. Thank you very much, Professor David Lloyd from Riverside, University of California at Riverside, and filmmaker Eliyahu Unger Sargon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Esty.
My pleasure, too. Thanks, Esty.
Through the brand Israel and other government-funded campaigns, Israel overtly uses culture as a form of propaganda to whitewash or justify its regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid over the Palestinian people. Just as South African anti-apartheid activists had called on international artists, writers, and cultural institutions to culturally boycott South Africa, Palestinians for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel urges international cultural workers and cultural organizations, including unions and associations, to boycott and or work towards the cancellation of events, activities, agreements, or projects involving Israel, its lobby groups, or its cultural institutions. International venues and festivals are asked to reject funding of any form of sponsorship from the Israeli government. Thousands of artists across the world now refuse to perform in Israel, including a host of global superstars, including Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, Lauryn Hill, and Chuck D. Last month, in spite of this call and great public outcry and personal pleas from fellow performers for them to cancel their scheduled concert in Tel Aviv, Radiohead chose to play there, prompting the Jerusalem Post to report, quote, "If York and friends deem it acceptable to play in Israel, the significance of that decision has much more far-reaching implications than dozens of shows by Britney Spears, Guns N' Roses, Aerosmith, and hosts of other finely tuned greatest hits legacy acts ever could." The article noted that Roger Waters had sent York an email earlier this year expressing concern about Radiohead crossing the BDS picket line to perform in Israel, and continued on to note that the letter prompted a tirade from York published in Rolling Stone, which turned out to be the best Hasbara Israel received lately, excluding Gal Gadot's stint as Wonder Woman. RT America's Anya Parampil recently sat down with Roger Waters for a fantastic one-on-one interview when he was in Washington, D.C. on his Us and Them concert tour. I am grateful that she has taken the time to be with us today to share some of that interview with us. Anya
Hi, Esty.
Hi, Anya. I want to introduce you a little more for our audience who don't know you. Anya Parampil is a correspondent for RT America in Washington, D.C. Before joining the news team, she was a producer on the hit show Breaking the Set with Abby Martin. She's mainly interested in reporting on criminal and economic justice, embodied in her fantastic reporting on the Baltimore uprising in 2015. With a background in international affairs, she also enjoys conducting interviews with a range of experts on U.S. foreign policy. It is my great pleasure to welcome another friend, Anya Parampil, to Middle East in Focus. Do we still have you, Anya? Oh, it seems like we might have lost Anya. We definitely have lost Anya. While our control room works to get her back, I wonder, Eliyahu, if you had been reading any of the debate going on in the news over Radiohead's recent concert in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, of course. And it's been very interesting because it's a sort of recurring story that you see over and over. The BDS movement, the cultural wing of the BDS movement approaches an artist and asks them not to perform, and the artist either accepts or crosses the picket line, as it were. And in the case of Radiohead, I think largely because of just how popular they are and the sort of status, their status is sort of countercultural icons, I think it got a lot more coverage than some other artists have.
Okay, I think we have Anya back.
Yes, I hope so.
Okay, I hope you stay with us. You set up your interview with Roger Waters by drawing the very apt analogy between the great singer, artist, and activist of the McCarthy era, Paul Robeson, and the current attempt by supporters of Israel and their continued occupation and colonization of Palestine to demonize Roger Waters' support for Palestinian human rights and his observance of the BDS call. I wonder if you can discuss a little bit that analogy that you made about what happened to Paul Robeson at one of his concerts and what some legislators in New York are trying to do in regards to Roger Waters' upcoming concert there. Oh, for heaven's sakes, we've lost Anya again. These are the joys of live radio. So, Eliyahu,
yes,
as an artist,
yes,
following this debate, waiting along with me to see if we can get Anya back on the line, how did you feel when Tom York and Radiohead decided to go ahead and play there?
Yeah, I mean, I was disappointed. I'm a strong believer in the cultural side of the boycott. I think it sends a message in a way that other sides of the boycott are not able to send, and it sort of hits where it hurts a little more, as it were, which I think is fine. I mean, I obviously, as an artist, have complicated feelings about cultural boycotts. But in this instance, I think we need to follow the lead of the Palestinian people, and they have asked us to do this. They are leading their struggle for equal rights, and I can't – whatever objections I might have in general to cultural boycotts or the boycotting of art in this instance are overridden by what I feel is a very important and deep moral responsibility to correct the situation in Israel-Palestine.
Right, and the complexity comes that the Palestinian people aren't really in a position to boycott Israel. The goods and services that they have access to, you know, are limited, and in some places are mostly Israeli products.
Yeah, I think that's a part of the complexity. I think another part of the complexity is what I call endgame considerations, which is if you have a vision for the future of this place, one would hope that it involves some kind of reconciliation, cultural, psychological, emotional reconciliation. And by cutting off channels of communication and artistic expression, on some level, it feels like you're delaying that process in some way. But I don't see an alternative at this point in time, given the urgent nature of the human rights emergency that is that is Palestine.
Right. We have Anya back, so I hope that you can tell us about this analogy that you set out to open your piece, your interview with Roger Waters.
Happily, Esty. So I introduced the segment I did with Roger by talking about something that happened in August 1949 in New York State. And the reason we're talking about New York State is because Roger Waters, as one of the most, if not the most high-profile supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in Israel, is currently facing a campaign, or for Palestinian rights, I should say, is currently facing a campaign in New York State to shut down a performance of his at the Nassau Coliseum in the state. And this is happening because legislators in New York recently failed to pass state legislation barring artists or targeting artists who choose to participate in the cultural boycott of Israel. And so New York Governor Andrew Cuomo went ahead and signed an executive order making it law. And he published an op-ed in the Washington Post basically saying, if you boycott Israel, we will boycott you. And now because of that, this upcoming concert of Roger's, which is coming up as part of his Us and Them tour, is being threatened. Legislators in the state are saying as a result of this new legislation, they would like to see Roger not able to perform in New York State. So let's go back to 1949, where it's the dawn of the Cold War, and actor and singer Paul Robeson, the renowned bass singer, actor, not just in the United States but around the world, was scheduled to perform a benefit concert for the Civil Rights Congress near Peekskill, New York. And what happened was right-wing media essentially ran a campaign using the tension of the Cold War to attack Robeson as a communist. Of course, he was also an outspoken civil rights activist, especially as a Black American. That was something he was often targeted for in the media, and they successfully riled up a crowd of right-wingers to come in and attack concert throwers or concert goers, throwing rocks at them, hitting them with baseball bats, and even burning an effigy of Robeson. And as a result, his concert was canceled. They were not able to gather that night in Peekskill because Robeson was blacklisted by our government for his political positions. And so the week I interviewed Roger, a local piece, op-ed in Newsday, local news in Nassau County, published an article comparing what happened to Robeson to what's happening to Roger now and saying it seems like, again, now in 2017, legislators, our political leaders are willing to engage in a blacklisting of activists and try, or of artists for their activism, and deny them a platform to even perform their work.
This is Middle East in Focus. I'm speaking with Anya Parampil of RT America about her fantastic interview with Roger Waters about him being blacklisted by the mainstream media in America due to his support for Palestinian human rights, and about our role as human beings to support our fellow human beings. I want to go now to a clip. It's our clip number two of part of your interview with Roger Waters.
Let's get into the government, because in defending his band's decision to play in Israel, Radiohead frontman Tom York said playing in a country isn't an endorsement of the government, pointing out the group doesn't endorse Trump but still plays in the States. Why is Israel different?
That's a two-part question. All right. Tom York is wrong about not endorsing the policies of the Israeli government by playing there. Spokespersons of that government have said how excited they are that this is the best thing that's happened for their Hasbara, which is the explaining to the rest of the world what a wonderful and precious democracy Israel is. And willy-nilly, when they cross the picket line, they are making a public statement that they do endorse the policies of the government, whatever they say, because that is what will be reported in Israel, and that is what gets reported around the world. That is why Radiohead are being so soundly criticized by anybody with progressive ideas about human rights, because they have taken that step. The other thing is about not performing in the United States or trying to boycott the United States. The people of the United States have not got together as a civil society and asked performers from the rest of the world not to come and perform in the United States because they are an occupied people and there is an organized resistance against the occupying army. Civil society in Palestine in 2005 started the BDS movement themselves. This isn't something imposed by a bunch of foreign rock musicians. This is something that they started, that they have organized, and they have made an appeal to all artists, writers, musicians, actors, directors, anybody in the rest of the world to observe the picket line which they have drawn, and to ask us not to to observe a cultural boycott of the country.
So, Anya, Roger Waters really sounds well-informed about the Palestinian-led BDS movement. I wonder if that was your impression. And I also wonder if you know his story about how he became involved in the BDS movement.
Sure. It's definitely obvious from talking to Roger. I'm very aware he's been very active in the Palestine cause. He attended the tribunal a few years ago. Some of these crimes the Israeli government have committed, and he really
Anya, you're cutting in and out. I'm not sure if you're stationary or moving, but you're cutting in
and
out.
I'm stationary.
Okay.
Should I continue?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry for the bad connection, but essentially his story is in 2006, right after Palestinian civil society came together to ask, start BDS and ask to participate in the cultural exhibit. Roger was approached by activists who wanted to educate him about the campaign with considering his scheduled concert. And he said, since he has an open mind and has been committed to issues of justice for his life, he heard them out. And once he did, he decided to go ahead with the concert at a different venue, a place he considered to be, or was considered, where it was considered to be more inclusive, a place known as Neve Shalom Peace Village in Israel. And he performed. A crowd of about 50,000 people showed up. It's been described as Woodstock-like. And at the end, he made a statement saying something along the lines of, we need this generation of Israelis to tear down the walls and make peace with their neighbors. The way I've heard him tell that is after he said that, after this concert, very successful concert of, the crowd enjoying every moment of it, he said they fell silent. Once he made that statement. And since then, he's been very vocal about the issue, doesn't perform in Israel, and anyone who's familiar with his work and with the cause wouldn't be so surprised that Roger's committed to a cause, which one of their main demands is to tear down the wall in Israel, among other goals, but it seems like he has taken those positions in his music and applied it to this campaign now.
You also ask him in your interview about a topic that highlights not only the McCarthyism and policing of commentary about Israel's history and continued apartheid policies, but the role that the mainstream media plays in it. I'd like to play clip number 3, and then we'll have you comment afterwards.
You're one of the most beloved rock stars of a generation. You're very vocal, outspoken, and I would say you're fairly accessible. Why don't we hear from you on mainstream media or on popular late-night television shows?
I'm told that they can't answer that question, but that it comes from above. I was told that by Charlie Rose, not directly, but by his producer. Why isn't Roger on Charlie Rose then? We're not quite sure, but it comes from above.
Did that change
after
you?
So you can figure it out for yourself. It's not rocket science.
These are after you took these positions.
I've taken this position since 2006. It's a long story, but basically last 10 or 11 years. My presence began to be felt by AIPAC and by the Israel lobby in this country, which is extremely powerful. As you know, they're very, very powerful donors to all political parties. They wield enormous power in Congress, which is why, as we speak, there is a bill before Congress that is sponsored by, among others, the junior senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, who I've actually met in the past. I look forward to meeting her again because I want her to explain herself to me. And the bill is to criminalize BDS with criminal penalties for people like me. There's been talk of $1 million fines and 20 years in prison.
So we should say that since the time of that interview, Kirsten Gillibrand has taken her name off that legislation, and she is no longer a co-sponsor of it. We have lost Anya again, but I want to go to another clip as we try to get her on. She closes out her interview by asking Roger Waters about his current tour and how his fans may perceive it, including his Israeli fans, as he has quite clearly chosen not to play there. Clip 6.
Finally, you're on the Us and Them tour right now throughout the States and then I believe Europe as well. For your fans coming to your shows, how would you like them to take your music and translate it into action in their own lives, their role of humans? I hear you talk about that a lot, your role as a human being, especially your fans in Israel who might be wanting to know why that music can't be played in their country.
Well, it'd be very hard for not for all Israeli fans, because obviously I'm in touch with many of them. There is a big, big resistance movement in Israel. There's a particular organization called Boycott From Within, run by a guy I know called Ronnie Bach, and it's a proper organization, and they're extremely brave, because in the face of the intransigence of most of the Zionists in Israel, they are actually running their own form of resistance, because they are caring Jewish people who are deeply distressed that the policies of the Israeli government run contrary to the humane tenets of Judaism and what's actually in the Torah and what they believe their connection with their religion. I'm an agnostic, so it's really none of my business, but we do know that all those Judaic-based religions all have the same basic ideas about them. But you asked me something else. I'll tell you something. We've done 30 gigs in this country, and everywhere we play, because the show is very political, but people see it and they understand that it's about us recognizing the predicament of others. It attaches very much to the philosophical position that we should do as we would be done by. It's a character from Charles Kingsley's Water Babies. Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By says that, but it is incumbent upon us all and upon our politicians and on all those of us who think about people who might be on the other side of an argument to put ourselves in their shoes. How would we feel sitting here in Washington if there were drones buzzing around in the sky all day and we never knew when we were going to be blown out of our socks? Because a drone attacks, for instance, targeted assassinations, of which I have to say I could not have been more disapproving of when the last administration was in power. Why Barack Obama continued and expanded that drone program, I will never know. I haven't had the chance to ask him about that, and I probably never will. But I have no idea. It's hard to imagine a sensible reply. I mean, he might say, oh, well, we have to fight terror. Please, you must see that being that kind of belligerent, bellicose, deadly presence in 137 foreign countries can only encourage a resistance to that completely unacceptable colonial and imperialist behavior. It's inevitable. No, you can't cut the head of a state. Anyway, that's a long conversation. But what I've found in my shows is that we discover that that 10 or 12,000 people, tiny as that number is, are desperate to find, to be in a place of love for their fellow human beings, to support their fellow, if they want to help people. They don't want to be part of this administration's charge towards ripping the rug out from under society as a whole, giving it entirely over to the corporations and the few very, very rich, very, very greedy men who run everything. They want there to be a society where they care for their brothers and sisters. And they would like that to extend beyond the national borders of the United States, not just into Mexico and South America, and where Trump thinks the enemy are, but also into policies in the Middle East so that they start addressing the idea that all human beings deserve human and civil rights, including the Palestinians. In fact, from my position as an active member of BDS, especially my brothers and sisters in Palestine, who've been living under military occupation for 50 years, since 1967.
Anya, are you back with us? Hey. So I wonder if, you know, I was so moved by this interview. I wonder if in our last couple minutes you want to talk about the experience of interviewing him and your takeaways.
It was definitely a huge honor to speak to Roger. I spoke to him. I interviewed him for the first time almost 2 years ago, and it was a shorter piece. But this time we got to sit down and discuss something which was currently happening, which was first of all, the pretty high profile spat between him and Thom Yorke over BDS and also the campaign to shut down his concert in New York. And I found it especially interesting at this moment, SD, because of the wider conversation we were able to have about media. I think you played a clip earlier before I lost connection of him talking about how he's been blacklisted from outlets, and you know, he says at one point, I am allowed to come and perform my music on Colbert's show, but I can't sit down and speak on the couch. They don't really want to hear what he has to say. And I think USD, out of all people, would know, as a host taking on these issues on the radio airwaves, you're able to do that thanks to the platform KPFA as a public radio provides you. Most media companies in this country are owned by about six major corporations, News Corp, Telecom, Viacom, Disney, and there's a consensus there not to talk about issues, which not just, I mean, the lobby, of course, AIPAC plays a role, but just the broader interests of the United States. Israel is our major ally. We give them more military aid than anyone else, and it's a relationship and a system which isn't going to be challenged in the corporate media. And because of that, one of the most beloved and legendary artists of an entire generation, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I describe Roger Waters as such, considering just about everybody you meet has the same reaction. Oh, I love Pink Floyd. I've listened to them for decades. Because of his willingness to speak out on this issue, he's cut out from the mainstream media despite being, you know, not just any other celebrity, I think, someone who people want to hear from.
That's right.
And that's what I found most interesting about it. You know, there'd been not very many other times when we've heard Roger speak on such a platform and about these issues which matter a lot to him.
Well, we thank you very much for weathering the technical difficulties and taking the time to be with us. Congratulations on your fantastic interview, Anya Pumpriel from RT America.
Oh, Thanks so much, Esty. Take care.
As David Lloyd recently wrote at Mondawise, the contradiction between condemning U.S. racism and support for the racist ideology of Zionism has become steadily more glaring. But the same awareness has yet to extend to the remarkably similar and equally consequential worldview of Zionism. Right-wing Israeli youth rampage through the Palestinian quarter of the Old City, chanting the same virulent racist supremacism as American fascists, while Israeli police arrest the counter-demonstrators. Once again, I want to thank my guests, Professor David Lloyd. David is a distinguished professor of English at the University of California, Riverside, and a founding member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, writer and award-winning filmmaker, and great last-minute substitute when we lose our guest, filmmaker Eliyahu Unger Sargon, and RT America correspondent Anya Parampil. I also want to thank our fantastic engineer Rick and our wonderful intern Akil. Our theme song is the overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for taking this hour to put the Middle East in focus.
Could it be your honey, Billy? Ain't good enough for me, Billy Honeybee. Could it be you got enough for a lot of queen bees, Billy Honey, Billy Bee?
Hi, I'm Petra.
I'm Tanya.
I'm Rachel.
We're the Hayden Triplets.
And we love KPFK. Please enter KPFK in a text to 41444.
Then add the amount you'd like to donate, 25, 50, 100, whatever you can.
Help keep KPFK fiercely independent and
give KPFK.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster. Join me Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. for Reggae Central. You'll hear ska, rock steady, reggae, roots, dub, and dancehall. You'll hear it all on Reggae Central right here on KPFK Sunday afternoons from 2 to 4.
Actors, authors, artists, advocates, experienced. Hear them all on Experience Talks, an eclectic magazine for the ears. Sundays, 5 p.m. Pacific on KPFK FM. Listen, learn, listen up, enlighten up. Experience Talks.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.